Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Lubbock, Texas, with a gust to 82. That was the highest ever recorded during March, April, or May. It also happened to be the highest non-convective wind gust that Lubbock has ever seen, meaning that not related to a thunderstorm.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
That was what unfolded across the Great Plains on Friday. That lifted a tremendous amount of dust out of the southwest across to the southern plains, sent it eastward and northward. And unfortunately, that resulted in a number of chain reaction automobile and truck accidents across the region. That was tremendously disruptive to transportation. Also not ideal for winter wheat, which is trying to make it through what has been a very dry winter and early spring period following much needed precipitation way back in November.
This is Agriculture Today.
Prices are still rising, just at a decreasing rate.
USDA Economic Research Service Ag Economist Megan Schweitzer.
And so sometimes it can be easy to glance at a figure like this and think that prices are actually falling. But price changes are still positive. Each bar is still above zero in each month shown on this figure. The prices just aren't rising as quickly as they were. And that's where looking at this cumulative effect is helpful, because consumers often aren't thinking about prices in terms of an annual average or a year-over-year change. Ultimately, consumers are thinking about price levels, how much their groceries cost compared to what they used to. And what many consumers have anchored in their minds as typical prices are prices from the time prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. And food at home prices have risen by over 25% since January 2020, prior to the onset of the pandemic. And then zooming out, looking at an even longer time frame here, so from the beginning of 2013, you'll see why consumers have this anchor, this comparison point for food at home prices. That's because the prices were relatively stable for a number of years, rising by less than 5% cumulatively over a 7-year period prior to the pandemic. And so even though we're forecasting annual averages, it's good for us to understand and to monitor these different views of price changes as we're assessing the changes and the impacts from them. So getting into our forecasts, so here we take a look at changes in food prices. So again, this is all food, both food at home and food away from home, and our forecast for 2025 in the context of the past 20 years. So in 2024, food prices rose by 2.3%. And in 2025, food prices are forecast to increase by 3.4%. And so that forecast for 2025 is slightly above average. The average is 2.9 per year over the past 20 years. But our forecast for 2025 is below the increases we saw each year from 2020 to 2023. And so the point value of this forecast, the size of the bar, 3.4%, that's our best estimate of price change for food in 2025. And we also publish with this forecast a 95% prediction interval, which is a statistical measure of the uncertainty of our forecast. So 19 times out of 20, we expect that the eventual 2025 price change will fall within the range of that bar. And it currently ranges from 1.1% to 5.9%. And each time we update our forecast throughout the year, that bar will narrow. And as new data are incorporated each month and our forecast for the year becomes more certain. So then breaking it down into the two major components of food spending. Here we're looking at food away from, or food at home, or groceries. And next will be food away from home. So for food at home, prices rose by 1.2% in 2024. And that was well below the 20-year average of 2.6%. Food at home prices are predicted to increase by 3.3% in 2025, which is slightly higher than the 20-year average. And then as you can see, food at home prices have more volatility year to year than all food prices. And so here we're looking at food away from home prices. And while food at home prices have shown more volatility from year to year, prices for food away from home pretty consistently increase from year to year. Food away from home prices rose by 4.1% in 2024. And we predict prices for food away from home to increase by 3.4% in 2025. Which is right around the 20-year average for the category. And also with 3.3% growth predicted for food at home and 3.4% for food away from home, we're really expecting more of a convergence between the two categories in 2025 compared to recent years, when in 2022, food at home prices really spiked. And then in 2023 and 2024, food away from home prices were slower to moderate compared to food at home.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Definitely seeing some stronger prices kind of across the board.
Tyler Cousins is the director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
So look at some of those steer prices, feeder steer prices on the kind of weight breakdown, specifically looking at Dodge City, Kansas prices here. Those 5-6 weights were $3.66 last week. That's actually up $8 from the prior week. 6-7 weights were at $3.37. That's up about $9. 7-8 weights were at $2.91. That's slightly higher than a week ago. 8-9 weights were $2.72. That's up about $6. And then those about 900 to 1,000 pound steers were even with a year ago. We look on the heifer side of things, kind of similar discussion there. Those 5-6 weights and 7-8 weights were about even with a year ago. That's $3.37 for the 5-6 weights and $2.86 for 6-7 weights. 7-8 weights and 9-8 weights were $2.62 and $2.45 respectively there. That's up about $6 and $1 respectively. And then those 900 to 1,000 pound heifers were $2.33. That's actually up $8 from a year ago. We kind of look across the board there compared to those prices to a year ago. We're looking at some pretty strong gains from a year ago. Those prices up being, you know, upwards of $20 to $30 to $40 across the board there for those steer and heifer feeder prices. So some strong gains there compared to a year ago. Look on the Fed side of things, steer and heifer prices were actually $2 last week. That's actually up almost $3 from the prior week. That's actually a $15 gain from a year ago. If we look at those on a dress basis, those steer and heifer prices were $3.16. That's actually up almost $4 from prior week. Still a strong gains there compared to a year ago. That's up about $18 to almost $23 for those steers and heifers on a dress basis. Now, if we switch over to the choice box beef prices, definitely seeing some stronger demand there for those cutout values there.
It's the current market situation, but what about retail meat prices and demand?
Retail meat price discussion, you know, we get that report as well once a month from USDA ERS using some of that BLS data. And so, you know, retail meat prices, you know, kind of in generally in February moved higher from a year ago for most reported meats, which could, you know, kind of lead to some higher CPI measures in the coming months. So one of those things to watch there. But specifically, I want to discuss some of the beef retail price measures that were in that report. So if we look at the retail beef price in February, it's actually $8.64 per pound, which was an increase of 7% from last year and actually the highest on record for retail beef prices. Now, the record beef price, it's noteworthy as it comes during February, which is often considered a slow month for beef demand and for meat demand in general. This is due, you know, kind of the slowing of this meat demand and beef demand during these, you know, kind of first quarter of the year. You know, it's kind of, you know, you think what's going on. We're kind of in the middle of winter and just people aren't outside grilling as much. So that demand does slow down. So seeing this record beef price in February is definitely noteworthy and something to watch. And I kind of flag that because, you know, as we get closer to the Memorial Day, that's kind of the unofficial start to grilling season and summer and people being outside more. And definitely we see a little bit more of an uptick in just overall retail beef prices. So something to watch here in the coming months. As far as other beef prices that were reported, ground beef actually reached, it almost reached $6 per pound in February. It's $5.96 per pound. It's actually a record, an increase of 9% from last year. Roast reached a record of $8 per pound in February, which was an increase of 9% from last year. Steaks came in at a record of $12.01. per pound in February, which was an increase of 2% from last year, and the first time that the price for steaks have actually reached above $12 per pound. So overall, February's retail beef prices were higher, and a few more record prices were set there on some of those cuts, which is a noteworthy thing that I'd noted kind of for this time frame that we're in as we kind of head into getting closer to this peak grilling demand season.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One way that we're helping to diversify ourselves is the crush capacity in the United States is growing.
Jim Sutter is CEO of the U.S. Soybean Export Council, USEC.
It's largely a biofuels-driven demand for the oil here domestically. There's a lot. We could spend a half a day talking about that. We won't. But that's increasing the production of meal. So we're exporting more meal. And that's helping us diversify because meal goes to different markets than whole beans. Most of our exports are whole beans, but the meal share is growing. So let me just touch on these, some specific countries here. Mexico, Colombia, Egypt, Bangladesh, Vietnam, the Philippines. I could talk about each of these for a long time, but I won't in the area of getting the presentation finished. But let me call out a couple. Colombia. Soy exports from the U.S. to Colombia have grown from 500,000 tons to 2 million tons in the last 10 years. And meal is a significant component of that. And U.S. food and ag exports in total have more than tripled since the free trade agreement was finalized with Colombia back in 2012. And incidentally, if you would talk to the Colombians, they would say their exports to the United States have also about tripled. It kind of varies year by year, but generally it's a very balanced trade. And for all of you that were like me, the day before Valentine's Day, you were out kind of scrambling around trying to find some flowers to take home to your spouse. I bet most of those came from Colombia. I was able to secure a nice bouquet of roses that said grown in Colombia. So that's one of the key things they export to us. And I like to think about that. So I kind of say that tongue in cheek, but I think it's a great example of comparative advantage. You know, they're able to very well grow flowers, grow coffee, grow cocoa, grow things that we don't necessarily grow here. And they are a strong importer of our U.S. soy, soybean meal, soybeans, corn, other agricultural commodities from the U.S. So I like to call Colombia out because it's a place where our market continues to grow. The free trade agreement is helping us with that. Let me call out another one that's on this slide, and that is Egypt. From 2013 to 2020, just in 7 years, soy exports to Egypt exploded, I'll call it, from 700,000 tons to 4 million tons. And you say, my God, what happened in Egypt? Their economy was doing well. Domestic poultry consumption, domestic aquaculture consumption was growing significantly. A couple of very large crushing plants were built, so they were importing soybeans, mainly from the U.S., also some from South America, but really to feed their domestic industry. And that is such a, we love that success story. It's really been great to see. Recently, if you were looking at the annual numbers, you would have seen a significant drop 2 years ago because they had a foreign exchange problem. You might have heard about the significant issues that they had in Egypt with just not having foreign currency to be able to buy things. Fortunately, that is kind of reversed itself, and they are up significantly. They're about four times for where they were year-to-date this year versus where they were last year at this time. So they think they're back on their way. But it really is a significant success story in Egypt. I could tell you stories about each of these countries, but the thing I think that is important is that we have a team of people on the ground who are out there building the long-term relationships in these countries, understanding what they need in these countries, helping their poultry industry, helping their aquaculture industry, whatever it may be, to be able to grow. And then, fortunately, we've had good supplies that we're able to supply them when the demand comes.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So we have gone out and we've asked our operators, where are you sourcing food from, as well as non-food items from?
Speaking recently at USDA's Ag Outlook Forum, Vice President of Research with the National Restaurant Association, Chad Motre.
We do live in a global economy where, while we do source a lot domestically, there's a lot of things that we are still sourcing from abroad. Certainly you see Mexico, Canada, and China up here towards the top of the list. But we also import a lot from Europe, which obviously made the news today. And in fact, you see our second largest sourcing is from Italy. So we all love, going back to our comment about drinking earlier, from Mexico and Canada, the thing that we import the most is beer, followed by either tequila or whiskey, depending on which country you're talking about. For Mexico, it's largely a conversation about produce. Certainly avocados have gotten a lot of press, but it's not just avocados. There's a lot of produce that we get from Mexico. We all, as Americans, like having strawberries and other produce in the wintertime, right? And so we are sourcing quite a bit from abroad. From Canada, it's largely a conversation about potatoes and oils. Those are, I guess it's also maple syrup, but, you get the idea. Certainly, our operators are certainly looking at their sourcing and seeing where those, what those challenges might be. As well as for China, China is a little bit less of a story. It's more of a seafood story. The China story is really more of a non-food item. So we get a lot of our, electronics, appliances, gloves, et cetera, from China. So things to watch, and certainly something that comes into the overall conversation about tariffs. So I thought I would end here on a positive, fun note, right? Somehow The Economist before does something called What's Hot, which is not something you normally think of as an economist, but I'm going to do the What's Hot. So we do every fall, we do what is hot for the next year. And so this was the What's Hot we released last fall. And you can see here some of the trends that are hot right now. Hopefully many of you are enjoying them, like the hot honey. I know I like hot honey, but also a lot of Asian cuisines, wellness drinks. Hyper-local is certainly something that is also something that from a farmer standpoint also is very helpful, because it means you're buying a lot of things more locally. I'll just simply flip through that pretty quickly. Sustainability obviously is one of those issues that continues to percolate out there for many reasons. Number one, it helps reduce costs, keeps you more efficient, but also it's good for the environment. And then the top ingredients, hot honey, fermented and pickled foods, matcha, miso, and spicy maple, which we all like spicy maple. Everything goes back to maple syrup, right? And then the last slide I have is the macro trends, sustainability, value, right? And value really goes beyond just, you know, your fast food. It's into a lot of other things as well. Smaller menus, healthy kids items, pop-up restaurants, hyper-local, convenience, limited time only menus, flights, and AI integration. So that's a good one. I guess I forgot. I had this last chart. This chart also comes from our state of the industry that shows you that people like eating local. And you can see that a large part of why is because it helps support those local farmers.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Well, I think camelid feed won't be unhelpful, but I think the main driver is definitely the pretty significant rally that we saw in cash cattle land last week, bringing in some positive momentum here in, you know, into this week.
Bob Maurer is with Manduka Trading in Chicago.
Box beef prices, I think, are the one sticky element. You know, they've been increasing, but maybe not to the degree that the cash has been increasing. So the box beef prices need to come up because they're a big indicator of the actual demand out there, as opposed to just what it's costing those who are processors to actually buy the fat cattle on the hooves and process them. So we'll need to see that to, you know, continue to at least show some decent strength and bounce up a little bit higher and kind of join this party that the cash is doing. We'll watch that pretty closely. Certainly seems like the feedlots are in control at the moment, meaning they're able to hold out for higher cash. So that's a good thing. Technically speaking, we saw a pretty good dip in prices. So I think that correction appears to be behind us, just based on the big rally that we had seen in the live cattle futures for quite some time. And then we finally got a decent break, and that's healthy for the market, especially when you find some new additional enthusiasm on the long side. So came down to right about a technical level, the 200 period moving average, and held. So that technical level is, you know, quite a distance away from, I think it came in around 190 or so. And, you know, we're sitting up here in the live cattle at 205. So a huge 15-cent bounce off the technical level. And that's a good thing. So technically it looks pretty sound. As for hogs, a little bit more of a cloudier picture. If you look at the lean hog futures of late, the June, for example, they've been hit pretty hard, as was the live cattle futures for about 2 weeks there, and then we got a bounce starting about a week and a half ago. I think things are stabilizing. The pork market had seen a significant rally just like the live cattle did. So again, kind of the same point of a correction isn't necessarily liked, but it's definitely healthy for the market. And the fact that we're able to bounce about half that back so far looks pretty darn good. Cutout values stable, and I think margins are still profitable. They're off their best levels that they were maybe a few months ago, but still the margins are still profitable. The big, we'll call it gray cloudish thing out there for the hog market is just trade, right? So our big trading partners are Canada to the north and Mexico to the south, especially in terms of hams. for pork, and they had been a big and steady buyer of hams. There's some argument as to whether or not tariffs are really going to put a dent in their demand, because we do basically, we have the proximity to them to be the easy provider for hams. So it'll be interesting to see if sales actually start to taper off once those tariffs really start hitting on April 2, if they start hitting on April 2. But nonetheless, just that uncertainty out there and how that's going to play out. And then also to China with the tariffs that have already been enacted against China, how that's going to work its way through with ultimate demand. And, you know, basically it comes down to how long these things are going to last. So plenty of elements out there. Things look relatively better than they did just a couple weeks ago in both the hog market and the cattle market. We'll see if these rallies can persist.
Bob Maurer with Manduca Trading. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We focus on three main strategic goals as we do our work.
Jim Sutter is the CEO of the U.S. Soybean Export Council.
Differentiating U.S. soy, elevating a preference for U.S. soy, and making sure that we have market access or attaining market access for U.S. soy. And we do those things in a wide range of different ways that we do them. But those are the real key things that we're trying to do. So when we have ideas for new projects, have ideas for things we could work on, we pretty simply put them through that kind of a test and say, is this going to do one of these three things for us? And that kind of helps us know whether we should proceed with that program or not. So USEC is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. As I said, ASA and USB created USEC, but there's a much longer history of doing international marketing. And prior to that time, it was done by the ASA International Marketing Group. So that was kind of a subset under the American Soybean Association. We've been active in global trade for a long time. Japan since 1956, the Americas region, El Salvador, Mexico, Venezuela since the 60s and 70s, Belgium since the 70s. You see that picture there. Singapore, we opened our Southeast Asia office in 1979, and then China since 1982. So now let me get into a little more. That's kind of the history of the organization, and that's everything you wanted to know about USEC, maybe more, but I have a captive audience, so I love to talk about that. But now let's talk about China, because I think it's on everybody's mind, and certainly in all presentations today, it's probably something that people are talking about. So I would call this a story about the success of diversification. And you may say, China, what do you mean success of diversification? So let's take a step back in time. I said that USEC, or the predecessor organization, started doing work in China in 1982. At that point in time, China was a small exporter. They were exporting some soybean meal to other countries. They didn't become an importer until 1995. So 13 years of work by the soy industry, probably working together with FAS, to try and turn that into a market. So soy farmers who put their first check off dollars, I think they were very worried. I've talked to some of the farmers that were around that. I was not involved at the time. But I've talked to some farmers, and they were worried about how much of the soy industry's exports were going to the EU and to Japan. So they were trying to diversify by opening up a market in China. Well, things change, don't they? In about 5 years ago, almost 50% of our U.S. soy exports were going to China. So we've had, maybe we overshot the runway a little bit on our diversification efforts. China is a big, big market. You heard Greg Dowd comment this morning that there is really no replacement for China in terms of a market for certainly U.S. soy, but for many U.S. agricultural products, just because of the sheer size and scale of that market. But we're happy that last year, the last marketing year that finished, just under 40% of our U.S. soy exports went to China. So from over 50 down to less than 40. So it's going in the right direction from a diversification perspective for us. But clearly, it's not a market that we want to give up. There's a lot of numbers I'll throw at you, but China imports 60% of the global trade in soybeans. So remember, they first imported in 1995, and they grew to 60% of the world's trade by 2025. Or 2024, last year. So we can't ignore that market. We can't totally get away from it, but we're trying to right-size our share of the China market.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Broiler production raised this month by 80 million pounds, reflecting really solid returns to broiler production. On the other hand, turkey production we lowered by 40 million pounds, reflecting consistent poor returns to turkey producers.
Chairman of the World Ag Outlook Board, Mark Chekanowski.
Broiler price forecast, we lowered half a cent, reflecting the slight weakening in the first two quarters of the current calendar year, but still expecting relatively strong prices for the remainder of the year. And year over year, broiler prices, our forecast is up almost 2 cents per pound at $1.31.3 per pound. Turkey, on the other hand, pretty consistent poor returns, poor demand for turkey in general, showing up as weaker prices. So we lowered our turkey price forecast by a penny a pound. It is now at 95.5 cents per pound. Currently, if that is realized, that would be still off 1.8 cents per pound year over year.